The hostile reaction of Google and Facebook to the ACCC scheme to regulate price negotiations for local news content is giving Australia a taste of just how hard it is to rein in those social media giants. On Sunday Extra this morning, we're going to take a broader look at how the dominance of American tech platforms plays out across the web worldwide and the challenge of platform governance globally. With the Director of International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Gillian C. York, who's based in Berlin. Gillian, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. What are some of the challenges in terms of content moderation that can be observed from the way, say, Facebook has operated outside the English-speaking world?
Let me use two examples here that I find really interesting. One is hate speech, and the other one is nudity. So these are two really different things. Mm. But I think when we look at them, we can kind of see how this problem really lies. So on the one hand, with hate speech, you've got the United States in a pretty unique position of not considering hate speech to be prohibited in any way. So it's still considered to be free expression. And that's not true in most of the world. So then when you have these platforms regulating it, of course, they're able to come up with their own sets of rules. But at the same time, the philosophy behind them is often based on this First Amendment philosophy, which is just, again, an outlier in the world. And so we see, you know, in countries where hate speech has much more serious consequences than it has in the United States, at least up until recently, you know, you see different things happening, such as what occurred in Myanmar, where hate speech on Facebook was implied to have led to genocide. And then nudity, on the other hand, I think is another really interesting example, because the United States is more prudish than a lot of the world when it comes to this topic. And so, you know, I'm living in Germany, I'm an American, but here it's, you know, fairly normal to go swimming at the lake nude. It's normal to go to the mixed gender sauna nude, but you can't post those things on Facebook. You can't post a woman breastfeeding if too much of her breasts are showing. And so nude expression is not illegal in the United States, but it's culturally taboo. And that has kind of worked its way into the rules of these platforms and has an effect on the rest of the world.
What about issues as simple as different languages? How does Facebook approach the question of moderating content that's not in English?
So, you know, I've been looking at this since 2010, and back then Facebook really, really did a poor job on this. Over the years, they've added a number of languages, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe that they have 40 languages at full scale, which means that they're able to moderate content at a reasonable pace in those languages, as well as, you know, having the terms of service and the rules available in those languages. But the world is bigger than that. There are lots of languages out there. And what we see regularly is Facebook kind of scrambling and not really understanding how to moderate in specific cultural contexts. And this is precisely what happened in Myanmar, where at the time that ethnic cleansing began 7 or 8 years ago, at scale anyway, they only had like something like 6 to 8 content moderators working in the Burmese language, which I believe has more than 80 million speakers. And so that was just a disaster waiting to happen. And then there are languages where they don't have moderators at all, and they've got to rely on machine translation.
With experiences like what happened in Myanmar, has Facebook improved its game in terms of international content moderation?
They've improved in certain areas. So they've improved in Myanmar specifically by adding, you know, more content moderators, adding more context. But I would say that overall, you know, they're still scrambling to keep up. And it's really disappointing from my perspective to see them investing money in kind of needless tools and needless things while not doing enough in this respect. I mean, we know that the company and Mark Zuckerberg in particular have plenty of money. They could solve this problem, but they don't really seem motivated to do so.
When these big, normally US-based, well, US-founded, often tax-based in Ireland, companies yes. move into and start up local offices in parts of the developing world, the global south, does that improve the quality of engagement and the understanding of local needs, do you think?
Not particularly. I would say it depends on the company. Yeah, I'd say it depends on the company and the country and who they hire. But one of the problems that we've seen, and this is playing out right now with one of the executives in India, is that Facebook has a tendency to hire people really close to the ruling party or ruling government. And so, of course, this can have a negative impact on activists, on journalists, as those folks are often, you know, trying, their job is often not to you know, not to make things better for the local population, but to smooth things over with the government that they're working under. You know, and so when we see Facebook and Twitter, they opened offices in Dubai in the earlier half of this decade. That was something that was really concerning to me as well, because, you know, the UAE is not exactly a bastion of freedom. And by placing their staff there, they're not really doing much for the populations of other countries in that region.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Gillian C. York, who's the Director of International Freedom of Expression for EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Gillian, you were involved in the development of something called the Santa Clara Principles. Can you tell us what the Santa Clara Principles are and how they came about?
Sure. So the Santa Clara Principles, so named because they were developed at a conference in Santa Clara of California. They're on transparency and accountability and content moderation. And they came out of this, you know, this side meeting that I'd helped arrange that was really just an attempt to bring together some NGOs and academic experts that were all working on content moderation. And what the principles focus on is three areas. So the first is numbers, that we want companies to publish the number of posts that they remove and accounts that they permanently or temporarily suspend because of content guideline violations. The second one is notice. So that's just really letting users know what they've done wrong, why their content's been taken down, and the reason for the removal or suspension. We also want them, of course, to let users know how they can appeal, which brings me to number three, which is making sure that users have a meaningful opportunity to appeal content that was wrongfully removed.
And on the face of it, they seem like pretty basic sort of entry-level principles that should be adopted. What's the actual practice at the moment? Let's go through them. In terms of numbers, is there actually transparency on the number of posts that are removed and why?
No. So at least not to our standards. So there are some companies that do it. When it comes to legal requests as well as platform policy requests, and that's what, you know, we use to refer to proprietary terms of service content takedowns, you've got some companies that are great about this. Apple, GitHub. Apple, GitHub, Pinterest, Medium, Reddit is excellent on this matter, Snapchat, WordPress, and YouTube. But interestingly enough, Facebook is falling behind all of those companies, despite having more money than most of them. And so, you know, that's really disappointing for us. Twitter's also, they do pretty well when it comes to legal requests. They've always been really transparent in that area, but they're not transparent about content moderation takedowns.
What about notice? That's just, you know, individuals finding out why they've been taken down. Is the picture the same there?
No, it's actually quite different. So Facebook does do this, as well as Apple and GitHub and Reddit, but none of the other companies that EFF surveyed stand up on this principle.
Right. And then I suppose the third area, and this is something that's had a lot of attention, particularly from Facebook, with the idea of this new sort of oversight board, which is coming in. What are the existing mechanisms for appeal for the big social media players, and how should that change?
Yeah, so if you'd asked me this question in February, I would have given you a different answer. Back then, we would have said Apple and GitHub, Google, LinkedIn, Medium, Pinterest, Reddit, Tumblr, and Twitter, WordPress, and YouTube, whew, got them all, that they were all doing great. But since the pandemic hit, a lot of these platforms have kind of fallen backwards on this matter. They've reverted to using automated systems and not being able to actually respond to every appeal, which has really been disastrous for a number of people that we've spoken to, particularly in certain regions. So we've been getting a lot of comments and concerns from folks, especially in the Middle East and India, where they've just found no way to appeal during this this time. And that's, you know, it's kind of for an understandable reason that content moderators, largely based in the Philippines, at least when it comes to the English language, have been under lockdown. So they haven't been able to go to the office, and we don't know when they're going to be able to return. And so because of that, the companies have had to rely much more heavily on machine learning and automation.
I've heard also that at the same time, there has been more sort of interventionist content moderation because of the pandemic, and in particular, counteracting disinformation about COVID-19. Is that your observation?
Yes. Yeah. And it's actually really interesting because it's sort of funny after observing this for a decade to find where the threshold is, where companies will finally act on disinformation. And it turns out that this is it. So, you know, they weren't willing to act when it came to Charlottesville and white supremacy. They weren't willing to act when it came to vaccine misinformation. Let me say they, I mean, kind of Facebook and Twitter on this one. There were companies that did step forward, like Pinterest, you know, to say that anti-vax information was prohibited. But yeah, during the pandemic, we've seen a lot more action from companies, both when it comes to misinformation, but also when it comes to hate speech and in particularly white supremacy.
I suppose that still then begs the question, though, of what happens if a person, regardless of their, whether we might agree with their position, but they're unhappy about the fact that they've been taken down. Do you put much store in, say, for example, Facebook's new oversight board, some of them with genuine pedigree in terms of editorial independence and judgment? Are you optimistic about the oversight board as a way of improving avenues of appeal for Facebook users?
Not particularly. So let me caveat that by saying that I'm increasingly optimistic about the independence and outspokenness of the members of the board. I think I was a little more critical in the beginning, but as I've seen, certain things emerge and folks on the board speaking openly, I feel a little bit more confident there. But the structure, the devil's really in the details, and the structure of the board is still quite problematic. Facebook appointed the initial cohort of 20. Those are folks chosen by Facebook, which is, I think, concerning and should be. And then the other issue really is that they're only going to see a handful of cases over time. And these are probably going to be some of the more controversial in terms of Facebook's purview cases. And so, we're not going to be seeing much action when it comes to the kind of scale that these content takedowns are happening on. But rather, we'll see some landmark decisions, so to speak. But again, those landmark decisions, if that happened in a court in the United States, it would have a trickle-down effect, but it's not going to in the case of the Facebook Oversight Board. They've said that one decision will not affect kind of the case law, so to speak.
Interesting. And to cycle back to where we began this conversation, do you have a sense of how that oversight board might engage with issues that aren't in English?
Yeah, that's also unclear. And one of my biggest disappointments about the Oversight Board is that it's 25% U.S. American, which is not at all reflective of Facebook's user population. So that's a bit concerning for me. There are a number of people from developing countries from the Global South who are on the board, and a lot of them are really, really great scholars and activists. But, they're still not able to look broadly at the entire world. And just because somebody is, an expert from Pakistan doesn't mean that they have any particular expertise when it comes to, say, South Africa. And so I do think that we're going to see some prominent examples come out of particular countries, but I don't think that that really solves the problem for the world. And I think, in particular, Africa is really a blank spot on this map. There's only one or two people on the board from Africa at all, from the entire continent.
And just finally, Gillian, you're listed as having an upcoming book to be published on the 2nd of March 2021 with an intriguing title. It's called Silicon Values, The Future of Free Speech Under Surveillance Capitalism. Now, this may be a little unfair. I'm not sure if you've even finished the book yet, but could you give us an outline of what you think the future of free speech under surveillance capitalism is?
Sure, I can. So the book is mostly finished. I'm actually doing the final edits now. This book starts with looking at the frameworks that govern social media and then kind of takes us through a little journey that begins in 2007 in Egypt, where an individual experienced one of the first high-profile content takedowns. And interestingly enough, reflective of our current zeitgeist, this was a video that showed police brutality in Egypt. And so it kind of takes us through a journey through the Arab Spring, looking at the past decade and bringing us through to the current moment in the US and elsewhere in the world, and hopefully draws parallels between all of these incidents and the ways in which power structures affect how these platforms are governed.
Fascinating. Well, congratulations on finishing the book. And thanks also for outlining the really impressive and interesting work that you do with EFF. Gillian C. York, thanks very much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
And Gillian is the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Director of International Freedom of Expression. And you can find out more about those minimum levels of transparency and accountability that Gillian mentioned, which are known as the Santa Clara Principles, at santaclaraprinciples.org.